Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, as the title suggests, I'm here to talk of the stories of films. And I tend to talk about production stories, development stories, marketing stories, release stories, all those bits and bobs that go to make the films that we know and sometimes love just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. What you've happened upon here, though, is one of my occasional special episodes. I really love doing these, and I really love doing this one as well, where I get a filmmaker I'm very keen on their work of, in this case, a man by the name of Kevin Reynolds, and we go through their career, and I ask the stories of their filmmaking journey, and basically, I try and shut up and listen as much as possible. So this time, it is Kevin Reynolds who joined me for a very long and open conversation about his career, and we go from films such as Fandango and The Beast through to the 90s period where he was making Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves and Waterworld, from going to smaller films like 187 to slightly bigger scale ones like The Count of Monte Cristo, Tristan and Isolde, and there's just a huge breadth of movies and a huge breadth of stories that we're going to be talking about. Couple of little things to bear in mind before we get started. At one point, we talk about a film called Proof, and I don't think I fully explain it in the interview, that Proof is the short film that Kevin Reynolds made that led to the movie Fandango. There also, the name Erickson Kaur comes in as the director of photography on the movie 187, and I drop in at one point in the conversation that he's a director now. He directed the recent reimagining remake of Point Break. There are also just little bits of technology beeping and creaking. I recorded this at home. I recorded this over Zoom. But for the most part, I think this has come out really quite well. I hope you agree. And I hope you find it as interesting as I did. I'm going to cue it up with a collection of clips from Reynolds' film. So you're going to hear clips from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, from The Count of Monte Cristo and from 187. Once I'm through these clips, I'll go straight into my conversation with him.
You ever sub here before?
No, Roosevelt Whitney High.
Roosevelt Whitney, isn't that where that teacher got stabbed to death last year?
Actually, he survived.
Anyone who disrupts a class is subject to disciplinary action.
Hey, Jay, see this? See, I'm already on house arrest, Holmes. There's nothing more you can do to me.
We put our teachers on the front line.
You ain't no real teacher, fool. You're nothing but a sub, I say.
I am a real teacher.
I'm a priest, not a saint. Well, on their island off the Italian coast.
Monte Cristo.
Yes. Use your head. Follow the clue.
The tunnel's blocked. I can't escape.
Keep digging. When you escape, use it for good, only for good.
No, I will surely use it for my revenge.
Here now is your final lesson. Do not commit... do not commit the crime for which you now serve the sentence.
That's it. Cancel the kitchen scraps for lepers and orphans. No more merciful beheadings. And call off Christmas.
That then was a collection of clips from the movies of director Kevin Reynolds, who I'm delighted to say is joining me from, is it Washington State you're in, I think?
Yeah, Seattle.
Well, Seattle. So I'm delighted to say you're joining me for a Film Stories podcast special where hopefully over the next half hour or so, we can go over some of your work and some of your stories. First and most importantly, are you safe and are you well? And is the world treating you well?
Oh, yeah. I'm pretty ensconced here in my little fortress, so everything's just fine.
Your career fascinates me and has done for a long time. And you were one of the very first interviews I ever did about 10, 15 years ago. And I found your stories compelling then. And I've got even more to nag you about now. But what I find particularly interesting is just like the about turn you did at the start of your career, that you trained as a lawyer, that you had presumably a well-paid job as a lawyer, and you took all of these gambles and long shots that you quit this job. And I heard an interview you did with someone else, and I appreciate I'm covering a little bit of their ground, where it talks about how you went to Los Angeles with $300 and a dream of making films. I wonder if you can take me back to that version of you and what was running through your head at that time and why you took such a colossal gamble.
Well, it's true. I did all those things. I think a lot of it has to just do with being in your 20s and being naive and not knowing what could potentially happen to you. But yeah, I was an attorney. I was living in Austin, Texas. I did have a job. I didn't particularly care for a career in law. I could have stayed there for another 40 years and always wondered what if, but I'd always enjoyed writing. I'd always loved film, but it just seemed like sort of an unattainable dream at the time. The one thing that being a lawyer did allow me to do is that I had some money in my pocket, so I could afford to make film. And the facility at the University of Texas in Austin was phenomenal at the time. Yeah. They had a fantastic facility. And they pretty much sort of let me do what I wanted. I had the run of it, the equipment and everything and the stages and all. So I started making my own little films, educating myself. They weren't very good at first, but I learned a lot. And after a year of not getting a lot of sleep and practicing law in the daytime and going back to film at night, I finally said I had to make a decision. And so I applied to USC Film School in LA. And I got accepted and I quit my job the next day. And I thought, you know what, I've got to try this. I mean, it's not going to kill me if I fail. I guess I can always come back and be a lawyer. So I went to USC Film School, did that for a couple of years, loved it, just lived that life for 24/7 for a couple of years. And, I was very fortunate after that. I got some big breaks.
But you took the gambles to get the breaks. There is the
option. I did. I did take the gambles. And I know that if I had not, I would still be kicking myself wondering, what if?
There's one of the things that doesn't come across in conversations with you is what you've just mentioned there, that you had this thirst for writing at a young age, and writing has gone right the way through your career. The last feature film you released, you're co-credited as a writer on that. Where did that thirst for just writing stories come from? Where did your love of the written word?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the older I get, the more I feel, you can train and learn to write and all, but I think to a certain extent, you're born with those genes. Mm. You're born a writer or you aren't. I think it's a compulsion. You have to have a pretty strong compulsion to want to sit down with a blank piece of paper or a blank computer screen and say, okay, I'm going to create something from nothing. But I had that. I'd always loved literature. I'd always loved stories. And so even when I was 12 years old, I started writing short stories and stuff. So I always really enjoyed that. And I suppose in some ways, maybe I'm a better writer than director.
I quite like your directing as well, to be honest. But
thank you. But I have an enormous respect for writers because it's such a difficult job. People don't appreciate it. You read a script and you go, well, of course, that's the story. But you don't realize all those words that were chosen had to come out of someone's head. Someone had to do that. And it's not easy, you know. Ask anybody to sit, okay, write a script.
Yeah.
And it's pretty daunting.
I mean, I fell in love with film in the 1980s in the UK, and there wasn't really a discernible path unless you lived in London to film at that point. Can you take me to what Texas was like when you were making these decisions? Was there an obvious path to be a filmmaker if that's what you wanted to do?
No, there was not. I mean, like I say, we had a great film school at UT. You know, the instruction was not phenomenal, but again, it was a place where if you really wanted to, you could teach yourself. So I read all the books I could get my hands on about the craft of filmmaking and just started from the basics of learning, you know, editing, sound, camera. And it was really a self-education.
Yeah.
And again, it's a compulsion. If you're compelled to do it, you'll teach yourself how to do it. And I got to a point where I realized I wasn't going to learn anymore there and that I needed some good instruction. And that's why I applied to USC, because at the time it had the reputation of being the best film school in the world,
yeah,
or in the United States anyway. And so that's where I wanted to go.
And so what were you towards your late 20s at that point when you made that left turn, if you like?
I was mid-20s at that point.
But you said, because one of the things I didn't know about you was you set yourself very precise goals that you wanted. Was it a 2-year course? I think it was. And you got to the end of that knowing that you needed to make a film to be able to break out. Can you take me into that a little bit?
Yeah, my goal, I've always felt, you know, if you're going to follow a path, you really need to set some goals for you, because it's very easy to sort of wander and get distracted. And so even if your path changes, it's good to work toward a goal. So my goal, thinking that ultimately I was going to come back to Texas and try to do independent film there, was to go to USC. It was a 2-year graduate program. And what I wanted to do was to finish and have a film I could show people, a short film, and a script I could sell.
Yeah.
And I managed to do that. So my thesis screenplay became the movie John Millis's Red Dawn.
Yeah.
And I was very fortunate. My graduate movie that I did got seen and recognized and led to my first feature.
So when did you, again, if I can just do the chronology, when did you graduate? Was that early 80s? Like, 19, sorry, it's not 19, a quiz show. Don't worry.
No, it's okay. It's okay. It was 1981.
So, to put the chronology of that in place, I mean, you've done Proof, but Red Dawn got made within 3 years. I think it's fair to say it probably got made in a slightly different way to the way you would have made it. I watched the John Milius documentary. I don't think I'm going out on a limb to say the two of you have contrasting styles, but presumably you were completely alien once the script was sold.
That's true. I mean, I really wanted to do it myself, but I didn't have any sort of, you know, credentials or reputation enough to warrant the studio risking that kind of money on me.
Yeah.
So they went with John, and John did have a different point of view. And, you know, God bless him. I just feel like the final product was more jingoistic than I intended it to be.
That was the word you used. That's... So when it
came
around,
I really wanted, I mean, my version of it was something that was more akin to like Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to just show, at that time in the 80s and all, you know, there was a lot of talk about going to war with the Russians and stuff. And I thought, this is just ludicrous. People have no concept of what a war would be like if you had to fight it here in our own country. Europe does. It's still fresh in their memory. Didn't know what it's like to have to fight a war in your own backyard. So what would it be like to fight a war in your own backyard? And that's where the concept for the script came from. And so I created these characters who ended up being guerrillas in their own backyards. And I was like, what would that do to people? You know, and because I was a World War II freak, and having read a lot about, you know, guerrillas and all, and what happened to those people. And so I thought the same kind of things would happen here. And that was my goal, was to sort of depict what it would be like to have to do it in the United States, because we hadn't had a war fought in this country in 150 years.
Yeah. I mean, I remember reading Patrick Swayze's memoir about the making of Red Dawn and them lacing John Milius's toilet with explosives and stuff like that. That doesn't strike me as one of your sets, really.
No.
Did
it?
I mean, when the film came back round for the remake, was it, were you utterly alien from that as well? Was there any question totally of you alien. Getting involved? Yeah.
Totally alien. Yeah.
So, I mean, the Proof story, the story of Proof to Fandango, you've told a few times. I think it's a fascinating story of how you sent this film to Steven Spielberg. Kathleen Kennedy rings you up and says, Steven Spielberg wants to go and meet you. And I mean, again, I think you've kind of hinted this is kind of like, youth is a real help here, just in terms of the intimidation of a scenario like that, of going into Spielberg's office. But do you have any particular memories of that first meeting and just kind of the canvas that he was offering you?
Well, in that first meeting, he didn't really offer me a canvas. He just wanted to meet because he'd seen the film and he liked it. And at the time, he was shooting E.T. Yeah. And so I went down to... it was at MGM, and I went down there and met him at his office, and he was very gracious, and we probably talked for an hour or so. And he just asked me what I wanted to do, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it was great just to talk to a family like Steven Spielberg. And I left, and I didn't really think anything would come of it. I thought, you know, he just wanted to meet and greet. And yeah, 2 days later, I got the phone call, and I was stunned.
And that phone call was what led to Fandango. And in confession time, the first time I interviewed you, I hadn't seen Fandango. and I have corrected this wrong, because what a joyful blast of fun Fandango is.
Thank you.
I mean, we across lots of interviews I've seen you do throughout the films, I never really get a sense that you're particularly fond of looking back at your own films. But I do wonder, with something like Fandango, how long's gone now? I don't really want to tell you. Let's just say quite a lot of time has gone since Fandango, and that is such a joyful burst of outdoor youth as well. Do you look on that with any more affection personally now?
Well, I suppose I do, because, you know, yeah, it was my first film, and it was also, and I've said this before too, I think it was that, you know, first film making coming of age story that so many filmmakers kind of have to get out of their system before they can move on to something else. And so the characters and the situations and all were sort of products of people I had known and been and all. And so, yeah, for that reason, I have an affection for it, even though it's very hard for me to look at it. Being a first film, there's so many things that, you know, you just cringe when you look at it and you go, why did I do it that way? Wishing you had done things differently. And I've told this story. I remember when I was at USC and filmmakers would come and they would show their films, and invariably they would never sit there during the screening of the film, and they'd come up on stage afterwards and talk. And I remember this one filmmaker being asked about what he thought seeing his films. And he says, I never watch my movies. And I was like, how could you not watch your movies? Why would you not do that? And now I understand it completely. It's painful. It's painful because you're not seeing it the same way an audience is. You're remembering the day you shot something. You're remembering what happened in a certain situation. You don't see it just as the story and the film being presented to you. There's so many other things that you're seeing. It's very hard for you to be objective about it. So consequently, I really don't go back and watch my movies.
Does time not dilute that at all? If I knocked on your front door now with a DVD of Fandango and said, let's sit down for an hour and a half and watch it, could you sit and watch it?
I could make myself do it. Would I enjoy surprise, it? I'm sure there would be moments that, you know, I was pleased with, but there would be a lot of moments I would not be pleased with. So
someone showed me the foreword that I think it was John Grisham wrote to a reissuing of his first novel, and he wrote in that that it's a first novel. It's full of all sorts of things he'd change, and he wouldn't change a thing. Is that kind of your, because you've said in the past you wouldn't go back and change your movies, even if you sat back and rewatched it now and cringed through it, would you just leave it be?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you hear about directors that will go back 10 years after the fact and they'll recut a movie or do their cut or something. And I just couldn't do that. I can't go back and that's a time and a place. You know, you kind of, if you're a filmmaker, you sort of mark your life in the movies that you've made, and those movies mark a portion of your life. And it's really hard to go back to that time in your life and revisit all that and say, I want to revisit this material. I want to rework it. I just couldn't do it. Yeah. You could do it within a year or so, but not much later.
But when films come back to, I don't know whether you, this happens to you, but when films come around for Blu-ray release or 4K release now, do you get sent versions of them and asked to check them? Are you ever tempted just to do little color corrections or anything here and there?
No, I mean, invariably what they'll do is they'll send you, because they're required to by the guild, they'll send you a notice that they're gonna edit a film for television, because right. they'll either have to cut it down or whatever for television format. And they'll ask if you want to be part of that process. They have to ask you if you want to do that. And I've never wanted to be part of that process.
Not for any of the disc releases or anything at any point. It's just like,
no.
Because I mean, you talk about filmmakers changing their films. I mean, Michael Mann's Last of the Mohicans is kind of legendary for it's really hard to find the original version of that. That sort of happened in the UK with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves now, which I'll come to shortly. But it's just the extended version. That's the only one we seem to be able to have. So whether you've willed it or not, that sort of happened to you.
Okay.
Events just kind of happened. One of the things that strikes me a lot about your films, and I mean, particularly as I viewed it through the prism of Fandango, appreciating there's some later on that changes, is just how outdoors they are. And I was always taken with an interview Robert Zemeckis did, contrasting making Back to the Future 2 and Back to the Future 3, and how Back to the Future 2 was all sorts of hell and he was just indoors, and Back to the Future 3, he just got to go miles from Hollywood out into the outdoors and shoot there. Is that your natural right. home as a filmmaker? Would you feel Fandango was kind of like germinating that?
Yeah, I mean, I do prefer exterior pictures. I don't really like to, you know, stay on a close set. I prefer the outdoors. I would agree with that. And to me, one of the important elements in any story is the place.
Yeah.
Because I think the place is another character, and it sort of imbues the story with, you know, a different personality where it's set. So yeah, I do prefer outdoor pictures.
Although when it came to Count of Monte Cristo, you ended up making a film that was primarily set in a prison as well. that's
we
nice
did thing. Have yes we did when we shot that in Ireland, we that whole prison portion was shot on the stage at Ardmore Studios, and that was interesting because the challenge in doing that, where you have scene after scene after scene that's in a prison, is you have to try to find some way in each scene to make it different, just so that, you know, complete utter boredom doesn't set in. So you have to approach each scene a bit differently just to make it feel different. And I had never sort of appreciated that before until I had to encounter it on Monte Cristo.
I'd imagine, and again, this is me from the outside looking in, something like Waterworld helps there, because you tell the story on Waterworld where you could only shoot 180 degrees. You could only point the camera in a certain number of directions. So maybe that gave you a couple more extra tools when you went to prison.
Well, yeah, it does. I mean, you know, you just by doing, you gain experience and you learn tricks and you learn how to what's important in a situation and what to look for. So I suppose if I'd done Monte Cristo as a first film, I probably would not have thought about the fact that you'd better find a way to shoot each one of these interior scenes differently just to make it interesting. Otherwise, it's going to be utterly boring. And again, that just comes from experience.
There's, I mean, just tying off Fandango and jumping around a little bit, I apologize for this, but there's loads to talk about. There's one little line at the end of, I don't usually take a notice of Internet Movie Database trivia because I've worked out how easy it is just to put nonsense in there. But you said something in an interview as well that seemed to tie to this, that Spielberg himself, when he saw Fandango, that wasn't the film he was expecting and he almost stepped away from it. And I wonder if you can put your spin on that, how you react to that. And I can only ask it now because the film is so well regarded, but that must have been pretty difficult at the time.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was hurtful, you know. Yeah. It was hurtful because Steven, you know, when he, in his defense, when he first saw Proof, which is one portion of Fandango, it's the parachute school yeah. portion, and it was like this zany action sequence. And I think Steven expected that the entire film was going to be that, you know, it was going to be sort of a zany action comedy. And, you know, while there's certainly elements of that in Fandango, at that point in my life, when I had to sit down and write a movie backwards, you know, when they said, we yeah. want you to do a full length feature based on this short film, I had to write a movie backwards, knowing that that had to be incorporated in the film. But when I sat down to write it, I was just in a different mindset, and I was more interested in something a little more soulful and introspective, and you know, the elements that Fandango has. And I don't think Stephen completely expected that, and I think that's you know, why he had the reaction that he did. Also, I think, you know, he was at a point in his career where, you know, the pictures that he was doing were more sort of action packed and all. Yeah. And he wasn't really sort of at a soulful place yet, you know, which he has been in several pictures since then.
And you went from Fandango to an adaptation to The Beast of War, or The Beast, depending which country I seem to be looking at the title in. Was that, I'm always taken, again, I quote Robert Zemeckis again, I find him quite fascinating, his argument that the film you're about to do is a reaction to the one that you've sort of done before. Was there an element of that, to do an adaptation, to try and test yourself in another way? Because it's a very different
Not consciously, no. It was just, yes, you change once you've done a picture and you've been through something. And so you just have to try to remain open to what's of interest to you next. And it just so happened at that point that I was sent an outline, really, of what was a play called Nanawatai. And they sent me an outline for something called The Beast that was based on this play. It was like 60 pages long. And I read it and I went, this isn't a play, this is a movie.
Yeah.
And so I sat down with the playwright, Bill Masterson, who's a wonderful playwright. And we spent quite a bit of time together, and Bill adapted it, you know, into the screenplay. And that was a great experience, working with someone as talented and as creative as Bill.
And I mean, your memories of that one seem particularly fond as well, whenever I read interviews about it, even if that wasn't necessarily initially met with the response that it got.
No, it was not successful at all. I mean, we got caught in the middle of a regime change at the studio at the time. And
which studio was that, sorry?
That was Columbia, and as so often happens.
I didn't appreciate that was, yeah, okay. The Coca-Cola era.
The previous regime, they sort of dumped, that was David Putnam's regime. And so they sort of dump all that product and move on to their own stuff. Because, you know, if it's successful, they don't get the credit. And if it bombs, they get the blame. So that's what happened to the Beast.
So you were caught in the sweep of the British are coming and David Putnam offending half of Hollywood.
Correct.
Okay.
But I was very proud of the picture. And to David's credit, I mean, we went into David, you know, early on and gave him the script. He said, okay, I'll take a look. And he said, how much do you think it'll cost? And I said, it'll probably between $9 and $11 million. He goes, okay, let me look at it. And so a week later he calls and he goes, I'll give you $7 million to make it. So we negotiated back and forth. And ultimately, I think the final budget was something like 10. It's what it cost us to make it.
These two films, Fandango and The Beast, are again, I mean, I talk about the response not being great. I mean, I don't like measuring things by box office, really, but presumably at that point in your career, that's the measurement that sort of mattered.
It still is.
Yeah.
But in Hollywood, it still is.
But there's a thing, I think it's Richard Curtis who said that after 6 months after your films come out, when people come up to you and talk about a film you've made, they're only saying nice things. It's the first 6 months you've got to get through all the horrible stuff and the backlash. And is there any truth to that, particularly with those?
Yeah, it is true. And I think that, you know, pictures that sort of stand the test of time, they're not always well received in the beginning. It's like this morning I was... I don't know why it just came up on television. I was watching it happen one night, a Capra picture.
Yeah.
I sat down and I read, you know, I was reading his autobiography and perhaps his most famous picture. Slipping my mind now. The one he did right after the war with Jimmy Stewart.
It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
And it was a bomb
when
it came out. It was a complete bomb. And it wasn't rediscovered until the 70s. And now it's like a holiday classic, and people finally appreciate it, you know, 70 years after it was made.
I've just been, just in the last couple of weeks, it's a completely different example, but the adaptation of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and how that was saved by American television, that no one was watching. I didn't even know it was a breakfast cereal company who'd funded that film. And the only way it found its second life was just through television screenings. I mean, you're in an era now, though, where your films are popping up on streaming services. I don't know if you've got lots of streaming services, but I see your films pop up time and time again. I wonder if you feel, I think you're away from social media and things like that, but I wonder if you get any of the warmth towards them.
No, I mean, occasionally, I take that back. I do occasionally, you know, people can be very kind and you know, have nice comments, but no, I'm a bit of a Luddite, a bit of a Neanderthal with regard to social media. I don't participate in that. So I don't have a Facebook account. I don't have followers on Twitter or anything like that. So I really don't look for that at all.
But are you comfortable with people? Sorry, this is going quite deep, isn't it? Are you comfortable with people saying they like your films? Do you feel easy with that?
Yeah, sure. It makes you feel good, because there's an uncertainty when you make something. It's such a product of who you are and your instincts and all. You know, and you make it and you put it out there, and that's why you do it. You hope that people will respond to it in a good way. And, you know, if they don't initially, but to find out later on that it touched someone, that means everything to you. That's why you make them, is to affect people somehow.
I wouldn't have tracked you down again if it wasn't for really liking your films. I mean, it would make the rest of this really quite awkward if I didn't.
Well, thank you. You're very kind.
But it's also, I mean, films, I think, have, you've hinted there, you don't see the long tail necessarily of a film until sometime later, inevitably. And I read an interview in the Los Angeles Times that said 187 came about because Mel Gibson's business partner really liked The Beast. And there's, what, a 10-year gap between those two films?
It could be. I don't know. That's Bruce Davey. I don't know if Bruce was the genesis of it or not, but Mel's coming. It was right after Waterworld, and I was quite down. And Mel, they contacted me and said, "Hey, we have a script. Would you take a look at it and see if you're interested?" And I read it, and it was pretty powerful stuff. I have to say, that working with Mel, Icon, working with Mel and Bruce might be the best filmmaking experience I've ever had with a company. They could not have been kinder. They could not have been more gracious. And I know Mel has had his issues, but he was nothing but a gentleman for that entire process. And that movie too didn't do any business, but I'm very proud of it. And
I went to see
they it. Let, you know, Mel let us, you know, he let us make the picture we wanted to make, supported us the whole way. And I will not speak ill of the man.
But were you aware of that interview, that the reason they tracked you down for that film was The Beast?
No, I was
there. You
not.
Go. So strange tales to films. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it's the Los Angeles Times. You would hope so.
Maybe.
you've hinted on an interview you did, an independent filmmakers podcast, which I really enjoyed listening to. I'm trying not to plagiarize, but you kind of hinted that there was almost an attempt to scale up what you were doing after that, before Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves came along, that there were other slightly bigger projects that you were perhaps going to do. And you'd done The Buffalo, that you'd done a bit of second unit work on Dances with Wolves as well. Was this a conscious attempt to climb at this point?
No, I, you know, I know there's some people that are very good, the filmmakers that are very calculating about their careers, and they decide this is a good move or this isn't a good move. I've probably, you know, not wisely, I have not thought that way. To me, it's all about responding to the material. And as I said, after each project, you're a different person, and what you're interested in changes. And it's just whatever strikes me at the time. And it has to be a good piece of material to get me motivated to want to tell that story. You know, when Robin Hood came along, I had been on and off of like two different pictures that came together and then fell apart. And then Robin Hood was offered to me. And I saw the potential in that. And that was, you've heard all the stories about that.
I like stories.
Well, I won't get into that. It was just, it was a very complicated process. But no, I did not, I wasn't consciously seeking to do a big picture.
The reason I ask is just kind of like a little bit of a paradox at the heart. First of all, you're a storyteller, but secondly, you set very distinct goals of what you wanted to do. And I by the sounds of it, the kind of the goal-driven bit melted away and the storyteller kept coming more and more forward.
I would like to think so. Would like to think so. It's just, filmmaking is very difficult. And so you have to be, you have to be dedicated to what you're doing 100%. And for me to be feel that way, to want to pour myself into it, I have to really love what I'm doing and love the material. I can't simply do it because, hey, it's a big picture with this movie star or whatever. I can't do it just for that reason.
The era that we go into, pretty much most of the 90s was, if I can just get through this bit in a minute, because then we've dealt with this bit, was an era where you were working with Kevin Costner, and every interview I seem to read with you asks you about, you fell out with Kevin Costner and you fell back in with Kevin Costner and you fell back out and he fell out with you and et cetera, et cetera. So can I just tie that up? Because I presume you don't want to get into the nitty gritty of that. I'm not a very good gossip, really. Are you and he friends now? Can we do that and then just get in?
No, sadly, we are not.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. It's, you know, listen, again, you go back and look in the history of Hollywood and, you know, relationships between directors and stars and stuff. And, you know, I'm not the only one. There's John Wayne and John Ford and, you know, Gene Kelly and Donnan, Stanley Donnan. It's just, it's what happens. And it's unfortunate. It's sad. I wish that was not the case, but, it did. It was sort of like a love hate thing. And, you know, we were very simpatico in a lot of ways. And unfortunately, it wasn't healthy in the end. It just wasn't healthy anymore.
Can I talk about the films instead then? Because that seems a lot more fun.
Sure.
And I'm not trying to dig up bad stuff or anything like that. Robin Hood was the first of your films I came to. It landed with me at just the right time. And also we're in the UK. I mean, this was going to be the summer of the battle of the Robin Hoods. And right. I mean, I know you were conscious of the other Robin Hoods, but my magazine tracked down the people who worked on the other one with Patrick Bergin. I'm just curious, were you conscious you were sharing the crew, that they were selling their services to the other one at the weekend and coming back to yours during the week? Because they said your breakfast was better.
I did not know that. I did not know that.
The catering was better on yours, they said. That's what I got.
You know what? It doesn't surprise me. Crews can be quite mercenary. So that doesn't surprise me.
If I got it right, you came to Robin Hood relatively late in its development process, but you made some very fundamental changes. I mean, you were the person who ripped up the idea of having green tights and things like that and just took it a little bit more raw and a bit more down to earth. But can you talk about the point where you arrive on a film like that, your biggest film to date, and you see all these different movie parts and how to make it yours to a degree?
When I came on board, and you're right, it was pretty far along in the process. And I said, you know, this could be something, but I have to try to make it my own and find something to me that's compelling and interesting. And I don't know why, as I sat down to rewrite it, it sort of landed on the sheriff and the sheriff of Nottingham. And he evolved in a way I didn't expect. And then, of course, once Alan Rickman came on board, it took on a whole other complexion. And working with Alan was just wonderful because we just fed off of each other, and he would sort of take what I had written. And he goes, okay, well, I like this, but what if I do this on top of it? And I went, great, that's great. So we just, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And yes, it's over the top, and yes, it can get campy and all, but it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun because I knew when Alan came to set, he was going to bring so much, and I knew he was going to surprise me, and I couldn't wait to see what he was going to do with it. And that was a joyous experience.
Does the version exist that has 20 minutes, an extra half hour of Alan Rickman in? That was always the internet. That was always the tittle tattle at the time.
There were other scenes that got taken out. Yeah. I still think the best of his stuff is in there.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to interview Alan Rickman before we lost him, and I asked him about his villainous roles. And at first, he was just like, "I've only done two," and he'd done three. He did Quigley Down Under, which is the film loads of people forget.
Right.
And then the joy that he clearly had with Robin Hood, right up to his BAFTA acceptance speech, was quite something. But what I didn't appreciate until I was looking into this chat was just how tight your working relationship with him was. And it did almost sound like you were fueling each other.
We did. And you know, we had a bit of conflict right in the very beginning. And I went, I sat down and talked in his trailer one day. And I mean, I don't know if I should share this or not. And I just said, Alan, you're the most talented guy on this set, but you're a pain in the ass. And he just went white. And I said, why do we have to do this way? And from that day on, we were just no more problems at all. I mean, we're completely simpatico. And I loved working with Alan. I mean, there have been a couple of guys, English actors, just pros, that I really, really have enjoyed. I mean, the other guy, he was not English, he was Irish, but he and Richard Harris were two of my favorite people to work with.
I must ask as well, it's often forgotten on Robin Hood that you had the mighty British export Brian Blessed working on the set. And I mean, I've sat through an evening of Brian Blessed telling stories. Do you have a Brian Blessed story from shooting Robin Hood?
Yeah. I do.
I wish I could frame your face.
I do. And it was a scene where we almost seriously injured or killed him.
Don't do that.
Well, I'll tell you what happened. It's a scene where he's coming out of the castle and he's confronting all these hooded horsemen. They look like the Ku Klux Klan and Alan's part of them. And he rides out and he's standing on top of this ramp on horseback. And, you know, Brian was a good horseman, but he came out, and as he started down the ramp, the horse slipped, his feet went out from under him, and the horse rolled over on Brian. This is a big horse, rolled completely over him. And I was like, oh my God. And Brian jumped up and he goes, I'm okay. And he got back on the horse and we did it again. And, you know, he was a trooper. That's the one Brian Blessed thing I remember more than anything else.
Well, my instant question when the horse hit Brian Blessed is, how is the horse?
The horse was a bit sore, but he did okay. He got up and did it again too.
He did also say there was a chance of him working with Kevin Costner. I didn't appreciate until, again, I was looking into archive news stuff with you, that you were looking at making the Blackbeard story altogether. Did that get close to happening?
Sadly, it did not. And it was, you know, it was just unfortunate timing. Yeah. It was right after Robin Hood, and I was actually in the middle of starting Rapa Nui. Brilliant writer named Mark Norman. He won, you know, he shared the
Shakespeare
Oscar
in Love, yeah.
for Shakespeare in Love. And I'd always loved Mark's work. He did a couple of screenplays that never got produced, other ones that were just brilliant. And Mark wanted to do a story about, I forget what it was. He wanted to do some of a seafaring story. Costner and I sat down with him and said, hey, what about a Blackbeard story? And he said, okay. So he just disappeared on his own for like almost a year. And I was in the middle of shooting Rapa Nui, and we got this script from him, and I read it and I went, oh my God, this is genius. It's truly one of the best screenplays I have ever read. It's called Ocracoke. And I wanted to shoot it immediately, but we had already agreed to do Waterworld right after.
Oh, so it was that quick.
It was that quick. We had already agreed to do Waterworld right after Rapa Nui. And so we were beholden to go do that instead. But consequently, Ocracoke never got made. But it's a genius screenplay. I mean, my other favorite seafaring tale is, I love Master and Commander. I thought
just going to bring that up as well. Yeah.
That's a brilliant film. And this is of an equal quality to Master and Commander, if not better. It's a great screenplay, and it has never been made. Never been made.
And presumably never will. Or...
probably not, you know, and it's just sad. I know it kills Mark Norman that it never got produced. And it kills me too, because it so deserves to.
You mentioned Master of Commander, and I didn't do the Lesser of Two Weevils joke, which I feel like I've let down fans of Master and Commander there. One last thing on Robin Hood. Were you conscious that you were the biggest regret of the outgoing British censor, James Furman?
I was not.
When he resigned as the head of the British Board of Film Classification, he said that giving Robin Hood Prince of Thieves a PG certificate in the UK rather than a 12 or 15 was the biggest regret of his career. That's a bit of a badge, really? Isn't it?
Yeah.
I'll get that made into a little t-shirt for you.
there's a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking going on. A lot of people have regrets about things they've done or not done. So
That's not a bad one. That's not a bad one. No. I want to move on to Rapa Nui because I found a story of it in all places in the official Making of Waterworld book written by Janine Paré. And she talks about that just the logistical troubles of you trying to prepare Waterworld, which I'll come on to separately, just while at Rapa Nui. And I just think this sentence just really just like scared the bejesus out of me. So from his remote location, it writes, Kevin Reynolds kept in touch with the design department on Waterworld via telephone and Federal Express. Divergent time zones and air flights that arrived on the island only twice weekly made communication awkward at best. So can you take me into this film that you, because you've told me before how you were basically cut off from the world, hundreds, thousands of miles away from anything else. But also what I hadn't appreciated is how much preparing you were doing for the project afterwards at the same time.
It was insanity. It was really insanity. I mean, I sort of liken those to my Werner Herzog days. I mean, Rapa Nui was sort of the apex of that. And yeah, it was true. I mean, we knew we were going to have to move on to Waterworld right after that. So we had already decided, you know, after thinking Australia or Hawaii, we decided on Hawaii for logistical reasons. But, you know, trying to work with a production designer and prep that at the same time we're on shooting on Rapa Nui, it was daunting. It was daunting because doing the picture itself was very hard. I mean, the island itself is it's 2,300 miles west of the coast of Chile.
This is Easter Island, where you film.
Chile. Yeah, it's 2,300 miles west of Chile, and then the next nearest landfall is Pitcairn Island, which is 1,500 miles to the west of there. And it's the most remote inhabited island on the face of the planet. Hence, a lot of the things that I think happened in the story, but that made it really, really difficult. Now they have flights every day, but back then, in the 90s, they had one flight a week that went from Santiago to Easter Island, then on to Papeete, Tahiti, and then it turned around and came back to Easter Island, then back to Santiago, and that was it. Other than that, there was no contact, you know, except for the occasional crazed sailboater that would come into port there out of their minds from being at sea for weeks and weeks and weeks. But that was the most difficult picture I've made.
You've talked about almost the island not welcoming you as well, and just the feeling that you were almost in the wrong place there. Can you just tell me a little bit about that? I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it's strange, but it's one of the most malevolent places I've ever been. There's a force there that's just very malevolent. And I don't know if it has to do with the history of the place or not. And I learned a lot about Polynesian culture and, you know, the whole idea of mana power that's imbued in the statues and all. And it's truly a haunted place too. I won't even get into some of the things that happened, but it was just, it was almost like the island did not want us to tell the story. I know that sounds insane, but I think there's something to that, and the islanders certainly feel it, and they talk about it, the forces that are there, and until you've been there for 6 months like we were, you can't really appreciate it and the effect that it has on people. You know, I spent a lot of time there. I don't need to go back.
Right. It was a case that you were almost like James Cameron making Aliens. As soon as you drive out of Pinewood, you're not going back there again. That was your... I mean, it's the hardest of your films to track down as well. That I don't know where the rights for that one have landed at all, but presumably you have no control over anything like that once they're out. Does that frustrate you at all? Do you want your... I mean, would you...
You know, I don't know what I would do with the rights if I had them. You know, people have to want to see it, and there's not a big demand for Rapa Nui.
Yeah.
So, no, it doesn't really frustrate me. You know, it frustrates me that I feel I didn't really accomplish what I really wanted to accomplish with the picture. It didn't work the way I wanted it to. And that was supremely frustrating.
But do you find things in it that you like? Are you entirely down on that one?
No, I mean, there are things in it that I'm happy with. I think, you know, we accomplished some remarkable things production-wise under the circumstances. You know, there are a few special effects shot, but everything else is done in camera. There are some pretty hairy moments throughout the shooting. It was dangerous. But again, what happens when you're a young filmmaker, you sort of feel like I can overcome anything. I can, whatever you throw at me, I'm going to work hard and I can overcome whatever you throw at me and succeed. And that was a picture where you realize, no, you can't always succeed. You can't always overcome some of the obstacles that are put in front of you. So that was an education.
So when you came off Rapa Nui and feeling like that and feeling you'd been in a place that was uncomfortable and unpleasant, at that point, if you could have got out of the film you were doing next, would you have just gone completely the other way?
Maybe.
Okay.
Maybe. I mean, like I say, if I had not done Waterworld at that time, I would have wanted to do Ocracoke.
Right. Okay.
The picture, the Mark Norman script we were just talking about. But, you know, we were already under obligation to do Waterworld. A lot of money had already been spent. There was a lot that had already been done in preparation. And I just, you know, you couldn't bail on that.
Well, the FedEx bill must have been enormous, sending you packages back. I mean, just on the practicality. But Ocracoke did resurface. I remember there were news stories popping up just as you went to do Count of Monte Cristo, that was going to be one of your three next films. At that point, so it didn't dribble away completely, did it? When you were
what was going to be one of the three next films?
That there's a report. I think it's on the Hollywood Reporter or Variety. That at the point I read old news stories, I'm a bit nerdy like that. But at the point you went to do the Count of Monte Cristo, you had Tristan and Isolde that was bubbling around there. Ocracoke was still being mentioned, and he says scrolling down his notes, and there was another one which was Morton Orwell. A project that had Antonio Banderas linked with it, that's linked to your name, which by the look on your face is a mystery to you.
It's a mystery to me. I don't remember that one. No.
So, I mean, lots has been told about Waterworld that I don't think we need to go back over in great detail. There's one or two bits I want to talk about in the film, but just for those listening on Waterworld, no, it didn't lose money. No, the main set didn't sink. Yes, it was the most expensive film ever made. Yes, there was a dispute between the star and the director. Yes, the film came out and made money. And yes, the critics were disappointed that it was better than most people thought. So I think that's a fair summation of the stuff you're usually asked about it.
I like that. That's a pretty accurate summation, I think.
Yeah. What interests me, and I think one of the things I try to do with this podcast is try and make film reachable, really. And I'm just trying to get to what the human being bit of it is like. Because you told a story fairly recently, for instance, just on the sheer logistics of it. There's one boat that's just got toilets on it. And I just didn't even begin to think about stuff like that. And you talk about how you had to shepherd 300 people a day to a set out at sea and then get them back for lunch and stuff like that. So if I got this right, when you did Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, you were cursed by the short British winter days and the limited amount of shooting time. How heavily was that impacting what you could get in the can on a given day? I mean, was there a couple of hours shooting time at best?
On Robin Hood?
On Waterworld. By the time you got to Waterworld and the whole logistics of just before you can become a filmmaker,
I mean, the logistics really become supreme. Creativity almost takes a back seat because you're just simply trying to get through a day, what you physically have to accomplish. And it was huge. We had a whole Navy transporting extras and all out to the atoll. We had to shoot a certain way. We had to shoot out to sea all the time so that you couldn't turn around and see the big island behind us. And you're on the water, you're trying to shoot on the water. So it was a lot to deal with. And it's really hard to appreciate it or even explain it to people unless you've actually done it yourself, because, you just can't understand it until you do it.
So I save my deliberately thick question for moments like this. And it's the bit that genuinely fascinates me about being at the heart of something that big. Was there any part of that you found fun to do?
Oof. Not many things. Okay. I mean, I suppose the one moment that I do remember, there was when we were shooting the big smoker battle on the atoll, and I was up on the edge of the atoll one day, and we had, you know, like 50 jet skis coming across the ocean and hundreds of extras on the atoll. And I'm up there with the camera, and I just looked around at the whole circus in the midst of a shot. We had helicopters overhead with cameras and stuff. And I just went, I will never forget this. I will never forget this, you know, being in the midst of this gargantuan circus, because these kind of things just don't happen very often. And so I don't know that it was fun. It was just kind of, I was awestruck, you know, that I was in the midst of all this.
Because the reason,
fun, no, I don't. There weren't a lot of fun moments. No.
Well, one of the reasons I wanted to ask you that was you mentioned Master and Commander before, and I've just gone through Master and Commander on a previous episode of the podcast, and there's that they didn't get to do all that you did on that film. I mean, arguably they did it in a far more sensible way. No offense, you know, they stayed close to land and basic bits and bobs like that. But that is the last big Hollywood film of that ilk that's ever going to be done in that way. And I wonder if there's just a little bit of it, because you're a fan of epics, you're a fan of cinema of huge screen. I wonder if there's a little bit of pride in something like that.
Well, there is, because even Master Commander, there's a lot of effects in that. And Most of what you see in Waterworld, again, there's some effects in it, but the vast majority of it was shot in camera. And so nowadays they would simply go, just, you know, turn it over to the effects team and have them engineer it on camera, because it's much easier to do now. You know, it's simple. Back then it was a bigger deal. It was much more costly, much more laborious to accomplish. So yeah, I take a certain amount of pride in what we were actually able to do in physical production on camera. I don't think you will see things of that ilk again. It's unfortunate, because you know the sort of wisdom in Hollywood is that big seaborne epics like that don't make money.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. But Master and Commander is just a fabulous film. It's a fabulous film.
It really
so
is.
So well done.
I like Waterworld, but no offense, I think Master and Commander is a flat out masterpiece.
Oh, it is. It is.
I think I like Waterworld more than you as well. I never hear you talking that fondly. But are you conscious that my last question on this? Are you conscious that all versions of the film are out there now? Did you see the really terrific Blu-ray set that Arrow put out that restored your ending?
I have not. I knew that they were putting it out. But I have not sat down and watched it. No.
I'll be knocking at your door now with two different DVDs. We're going to have a great night in. You're going to enjoy that. 187 was the film that you did next. And again, there was an interesting interview at the time, and it was fixated primarily on the falling out that the two of you had. But you made a comment in there about you were basically learning to like yourself a bit more. And I'm just kind of curious what the human being was in the middle of going from Waterworld to 187, if there was a little bit of a human reboot as well as a filmmaker reboot.
Well, there was. I mean, because I was, your confidence gets shaken and you get quite beat up and you doubt yourself. And so I saw 187 as an opportunity to kind of reinvent myself and to remember why I got into filmmaking in the first place. And you know, it was a smaller canvas, which is what I needed, a smaller canvas, because on big pictures like Waterworld, you know, as I said, it's all about the logistics, and every day you can't really change your mind in the moment because so much preparation has gone into these huge setups. So it's not like you can show up on set and go, gee, I wish we could do it this way instead. Well, you can't, because it would cost you half a day to change your mind, and a half a day costs $200,000. So you have to stick with what you'd originally planned. So you can't be really flexible. Whereas on a smaller picture like 187, you can. It can be more organic, and you can kind of respond to what's going on in the moment and adjust and adapt. And that's very liberating. And I needed that after Waterworld. And so 187 was an opportunity to do that. And I could experiment more. And I hired a young cinematographer who'd never shot a feature before.
He's a director now, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah. And we had a terrific time, and we took a lot of chances creatively because it wasn't expensive to do. And so we really experimented a lot.
So you say experimented, and when I interviewed you before, you just put a throwaway comment. I thought, oh, we must be joking there, where you said, oh, we just use toy cameras. And then I've discovered that you weren't joking, that when you shot 187, which is this terrific Samuel L. Jackson headline film, if people haven't seen it, which came out, what, 97, I think it was, you did go to the toy shop and get toy cameras. You weren't kidding.
No, we did. And it wasn't for the entire film. It was one scene in particular. And I thought, you know, because we were looking for ways to be different in each scene. And I thought, well, you know, what if in this one scene we did it as if it was from a security camera? And so Erickson Core, the DP, he said, you know what, let's shoot this. Fisher Price makes a toy camera. Fisher Price, yeah. Toy video camera. So we went out and bought one. They were like, I don't know, $40-$50. And we shot it on a Fisher Price camera and then transferred it to film. And that's the way we did the scene. It was great to be able to do things like that, you know, because as I said, you can't do that as easily on a big picture.
So you're a paradox again, because in some sense I see you as someone who's a fan of the huge old the huge old cinematic epics and the huge sweep of the big screen, but actually you're doing innovations there that wouldn't come along for about 10-15 years. And I'm conscious, I remember when I went to see, do you remember the Oliver Stone film Any Given Sunday? And yeah. The way he shot the American football sequences in, I have to call it American football. I remember sitting watching it. It's like the only other person who would do that is you. The whole idea of keeping your camera, because I mean, you used to talk about it as forcing the eye, which I always took as you just keeping your camera moving and keeping us focusing. But I wonder if you can talk to that a little bit, because there's all sorts of little innovations in your film like that.
Well, it's it's true. It's a, when I say force the eye, I mean, every director's got their own style. Some directors only like to work with the actors and they'll sit back and let the cinematographer shoot. Some directors will just set the camera down and record, you know, what happens from afar. But to me, if you're really into cinema, it's all about making the audience perceive a moment a particular way. And, you know, that's how I like to do it. I mean, other directors are like, Ridley does it. Spielberg does it that way. Again, it's a compulsion. It's how you want to see the moment, yeah. And you want the audience to see the moment the same way. So that requires a certain manipulation. And if you do it well, the audience isn't really even aware that you're doing it like that. Oliver does it too. I remember there's one shot, I can't remember exactly what it is in the one about the JFK plot. Oh God.
Oh, JFK.
Yeah. JFK.
Yeah.
That where, yep. There's this fabulous shot he does where he jumps out of real time and goes back into the past, and the camera moves into this scenario in the background where somebody jumps through a window and all. It's beautifully, beautifully thought of and composed. But if you're just watching it as a film goer, you're not conscious of what he's done to you. And that's the beauty of it, is if you can make the audience see a moment a certain way, but they're not aware of what you've done. It's like, I remember I talked to Spielberg after he did Saving Private Ryan. And there's a shot in that when you first meet Matt Damon. Yeah. And it's where Tom Hanks and the rest of the troops are out in this field, and this German half track comes through, and they throw a grenade at this half track. And Hanks jumps out, and these German crew come out one at a time, and Hanks machine guns them. And suddenly there's a shout in the background, and Matt Damon comes out, and Hanks goes over and talks to them and all. It's one shot. The whole thing is one shot. But you don't realize that if you're the audience, you're watching it, you're just sucked into the moment and the way it's composed and staged and all, but you don't realize it's one setup. And I talked to Stephen about it. And I said, that was so beautiful what you did. And he said, you're the first person that's noticed that.
Incredible.
But yeah, I mean, I appreciate people that do that.
I'm a very lowbrow person at times. And the film that showed me, the young me, how we were being manipulated was a sight gag in Airplane 2. With William Shatner. It's a really clever framing sight gag. And if I can dig out the clip, I'll send it your way. But it's okay. Just like clever little tricks like that in the midst of films that are otherwise completely forgotten. I'm running tight on time, and I've got a couple of films I really, really want to talk about. I mean, the Count of Monte Cristo, we talk about films that sound like a bit of a dying breed. here was a moment where Hollywood was willing to spend what a mid-budget on a movie, right. and to trust a director to make it what a 1,300-page book condensed down to what just over 2 hours.
Right.
And I mean, it was a film of yours I fast fell in love with, and I know lots of other people feel the same about this one. But I always got the sense that that was a film much more on your terms anyway, and that that was a bit more start to finish what you wanted it to be.
Yeah, I would say that's right. And fortunately, one of the producers was one of the producers, or he'd worked for the producer on Robin Hood 10 years before, and it was Gary Barber, and he had created his own company called Spyglass, and so they invited me on to do Monte Cristo, and we had some conversations about things that they wanted, but yeah, for the most part, they let me do my thing and do it the way I wanted to, and that was fun. Monte Cristo was a good one. I enjoyed Monte Cristo.
We've not talked about your casting in any of the films so far. I've sort of saved it for this one, because what a mix of Hollywood old and new there, because I didn't notice until I went back to it that Henry Cavill's in there. I mean, I rewatched Tristan and Isolde over the weekend. There's Henry Cavill. Right. You spotted him nice and early, didn't you? And then contrasting that was getting to work with Richard Harris. And I wonder if you can just talk about, just working with the actors on a film like that, because it just feels a bit special.
Well, it was. And to her credit, Priscilla Johnson, casting director in London, is the one who introduced me to Henry. And he was like 17 at the time or something. And he came in and I thought, yeah, he's perfect for this role, and so, yes, I cast him. And I think it was his first, film.
First or second, was it?
He was great to work with. And then, of course, there's Richard. And I had just seen Gladiator.
Right, okay. Because they were both filmed on Malta, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. But I just seen Gladiator, and I saw Richard in that. We were looking about for the role of the priest, Abi Faria. I said, "What about Richard Harris?" And they said, "Sure." So we went to Richard, and he accepted. And it was such a joy to work with that guy. He was just such an old pro. He knew where he was in his career, and he was so much larger than life. And he was the last of a generation of the O'Tooles and the Burtons and those guys. And they just had such a different outlook on things. And one of the things I remember is his ability to take a simple line and turn it in such a way that made you watch him. He gave it a weight that it wouldn't have otherwise had. And I remember one day looking at his script, and he would underline syllables of words, knowing where he wanted to put an emphasis, and it worked. He would take the simplest line, and the way he delivered it gave it so much weight, and you watched him for it. He knew how to do it. And
I was just going to say that there's an excellent podcast that far better than mine, apart from this episode, obviously, Team Deakins. I don't know if you've listened to any of those. And Michael Radford was on, and he talked about directing 1984, a film I'm very fond of, which was, of course, Richard Burton's last film. And he talked about almost being a bit scared that he was going to get Richard Burton, and Richard Burton comes laden with stories. But then he got Richard Burton, who knew he didn't have many more of these days left and was determined to enjoy it. Was there a parallel there with what you got here?
I think so. Richard didn't have any idea that, he was going to be gone in 2 years. You know, he was already talking about what he was going to do in his 80s and all. But he knew where he was in his career, and that, there was more behind him than there was in front of him. And he brought decades of experience and just a joy to it. And one of the things I remember, one of the most fun, we were shooting in Dublin. And I said, "Look, I want to go on a London pub crawl with Richard Harris." And he goes, "Okay, Friday night, we're going to do it." So we had this list of pubs we were going to go to and all. And we went out. We never got past the first pub. And Richard sat down and he just held court. And everybody comes up to him and is talking to him and all. And this is a guy who's 70 years old. And I stopped counting after he hit 10 pints. And I was just like, "Oh my God." I had like 4 or 5 and I was like done. I mean, he was a force of nature. He was just a remarkable guy. And I loved the guy. I'm so sorry I didn't get to do more things with him.
There's a British director, Mark Herman, who made a film I love called Brassed Off. But earlier in his career, he did a film called Blame It on the Bellboy, which wasn't well received. But he talked about he got to work with Dudley Moore. And what you don't see in the film is you get to spend hours talking to Dudley Moore. And I get a sense that, I mean, Count of Monte Cristo came out really well. But by the look on your face, you've got a locker of memories of those hours spent just talking to him.
Absolutely.
Brilliant.
Absolutely. I'll always treasure that.
One thing that was in the background throughout the 90s, if I'm reading this right, because you were offered, Ridley Scott tried to get you to do Thelma and Louise at one point. I'm sure you've told me that before. And he kept trying to get you to do films, and you interviewed him for The Duelist on the DVD release of that. That's how I know you're into DVDs, really. But eventually, Tristan and Isolde came together. And can you just talk about the other kind of things that Ridley was trying to get you interested in? Because that was, Tristan and Isolde was always, as it was posited, a kind of spiritual successor to The Duelist, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was heavily influenced by The Duelist. I mean, when I was in Austin, when I first saw it when I was in Texas, you know, and I was just blown away by this. Who is this guy? What is this film? It was, you know, such a gorgeously shot film. And, you know, today more and more people have sort of adopted that style. But back in the mid 70s, nobody was shooting films like that. And I was just blown away by it. And I was fortunate because I think there are only 5 prints in all the United States. And fortunately, one of them ended up in Austin, Texas at this little art house. And that's where I saw it. And then Ridley, you know, he saw a couple of my early things and he wanted to meet and, you know, graciously invited me in. Yeah, he did. He talked to me about doing Thelma. And I just didn't respond to it, you know, and he kept asking. I just finally said, really, you should do it. You're the one that's, you're obsessed with this. You should do it. And of course he did. And he did a brilliant film, much better than I would have ever done with it.
But there were other things he was trying to get you to do as well, I remember you saying.
I think there were one or two others. I can't recall off the top of my head. But yeah, then, yeah, there was Tristan and Isolde, which was another project that, you know, he had toyed with doing himself for a long time. And then, you know, finally this opportunity came along and we decided to do that one, do that version.
And was the, you talked about 187 and working for working with Icon, owned by filmmaker Mel Gibson, and a degree of protection that seemed to come with that. Was there a similar thing with regards Scott Free, that you had a degree of protection from Ridley and Tony Scott being involved in the film?
Yes, yes, there certainly was.
But also, if I've got this right, and I think you've hinted this to me before, that was a film that was just, I enjoyed it. Again, true confession, I watched it for the first time 2 weeks ago. I'm getting them all out here. I enjoyed it. I didn't know quite what I was going to get. But that was a film that you hinted was beset by quite a lot of bad luck, that you had shutdowns and things like that.
It was. I mean, I guess the biggest thing was our lead actor, James Franco, got injured, like, 3 times. We had to go back to Prague 3 times to finish the picture because he damaged his knee. And consequently it took them almost 2 years to finish the movie.
Did that affect the momentum for you as a filmmaker doing it? Was that easy to jump back into?
Sure it does. You know, it's just you know, when you're doing a picture, it's like a marathon and you just want to get through it and finish it and then move on to something else. And I wasn't able to do it on that one. That's the most time I've ever spent on a film was on Tristan and Isolde.
Came out quite well though, didn't it?
I think so. I like the look of it. I mean, again, that was one that where the look was very important. And I used a Polish cinematographer whose work I quite liked a lot. And I thought, you know, together we were able to accomplish some things that, I like the look of the picture.
I don't want to do spoilers, but the same strategy that's used in Tristan and Isolde is used at one point in Risen as well. They're more carrying under the shields as they approach I'm not accusing you of reusing things because I think both of those fit historically into those two films.
Right.
I should also note the casting of Sophia Miles, who I thought in Tristan and Isolde was just terrific.
She was good.
Yeah, I don't know quite where you found her from, but she was in a Doctor Who the same year. I don't know if you're a Doctor Who person. And it was a really wonderful performance in that, a proper double bill of stuff for her that year.
Yeah, casting's an instinctive thing. And I remember when Sophia came in and read for me and I was like, this is Isolde. You know, it was immediate. You know, there wasn't any question. And she did a great job.
I have excuses. I really am nearly at the end of my time. I apologize for overrunning, but
I've talked too much.
This has been fascinating. I have excuses for the last time I spoke to you, not having watched the two other films you've done since, because they hadn't been released in the UK at that point. So hopefully that gets me off scot-free. Hatfield and McCoys, what a joy. We talk about casting, but again, there's two things on here. Number one is, I think it's underrated, the casting in your films. I do wonder if you can just take me a little bit more into that. And I love how you give credit to your casting directors as well. I don't see too many people doing that. But also, it felt very ahead of its time that a big movie star heading to a television miniseries at a point where that was still feeling a little bit rare. I know we had Kiefer Sutherland with 24 and stuff around that time, but there was a little bit of groundbreaking.
It was. I mean, this was before streaming really became the thing it is today. But, you know, to his credit, Kevin, like myself, responds to material. And the funny thing was, I was actually in Hawaii and on vacation. My agent sent me the script for Hatfields and I read it and I went, wow, this is really great. Great script. I said, I'm interested. And and then he goes, OK, well, there happens to be a movie star who's also interested in it, too. And I go, who's that? And he goes, Costner. And I go, I know exactly which role he wants to play. And it was Devil Ants. And it, you know, he was great in it, but yeah, this was before streaming, before stars had moved to television, and the production itself was done on a relative shoestring. You know, we shot it in Romania, cut a lot of corners to do it, but I think it turned out quite well. And the cast was terrific. It was just a fabulous ensemble cast. And we had two casting directors out of LA. We had Fern Champion, who was wonderful. And then the Hubbards, Amy Hubbard, Hubbard Casting in London, who cast a lot of the UK roles. Because we didn't have much money, so rather than flying people from the States, we cast a lot of people out of the UK because it was a shorter travel time to Romania. But I just felt like we had a wonderful cast, wonderful cast.
The budget got that tight that it was economizing on the plane tickets of the people you were hiring?
Yes. We did that whole picture for $16 million, all 6 hours of it. We did good for grief. $16 million, yeah.
Did it feel a sense of almost coming full circle there, that you started doing an independent film effectively and using any tricks to get a film in the can outdoors, and here you are again?
Yeah, it does, but I actually quite like that because it forces you to be more creative. Forces you to, a lot of times you have to think fast, and in doing so you come up with good ideas, and so I like working like that.
The response to that one was terrific. I think that's as good a good reviews as you'd had at that point for some period of time as well.
I would agree with you. I think it was, yeah.
The question I wanted to ask is, how important is response? Certainly as you make more and more films and you see through some of the fallibilities of the Hollywood system and some of the fakeness of it, if you like, does that response become more or less important to you?
Well, a good response is what allows you to do more.
Yeah.
And so that's the real benefit of it. If you want to have a continuing career is, you know, you capitalize on the response to get the next one. I mean, the landscape in Hollywood has changed so much since I started, and just in the last 10 years or so, it's completely different. And I'm not really sure I kind of like the changes that I'm seeing.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's inevitable. Nothing lasts, especially in this business. Things are constantly changing and evolving. And we're just kind of in a dire time right now, I think.
I spoke to Linda Obst, producer Linda Obst, and she gone through what a 5 or 6 year period where she couldn't get films off the ground because she was chasing mid-budget grown-up adult films, as it were, as I think you have been for a lot of your career. And she's saying the one upside of streaming now is those have come back, that it is possible to get that kind of film that had been obsolete for 10 years up and running. You just can't get it on a cinema screen. It just has to go through a streamer. Which, that's if I'm reading you right, seems like 50% really good news, 50% really bad news.
It is, because, yeah, the pictures that I did, you know, 25 years ago, whatever, the $30 million movies, the mid-level pictures and all, you can't get those made anymore, especially dramas. Yeah. They just don't do them. The studios will either do big $100 million superhero pictures or they do low budget horror things. They think that's where the money is. So the mid-level stuff has really gone over to the streamers. The independent film market is just, it's in very, very bad shape, very bad shape. It's very difficult to get anything done on independent and hoping that you're going to get screen time somewhere. Because theatrical is just, it's just dying.
The last film you've done to date was Risen, which, if I got that right, came through a series of independent routes, but then got picked up by Sony. So it sounds like you've got a bit of a mix of all worlds there.
Yeah, I did. And that one came about in an interesting way because I was invited by these people. They asked me to do this project. They sent me the script and I didn't really like the script. I'm not a particularly religious person. The subject matter didn't interest me that much at first. And then they asked me again. So I went and met with them and I told them all the reasons why I didn't want to make it. And they said, okay, well, what would you do with it? And I said, well, if you're going to do a resurrection story, I mean, to me, and it just came off the top of my head, I said, you should do it in a different way. Almost like a detective story. And they said, oh, really? And I said, yeah, like a detective story, you know, tell story of some guy who's trying to figure out what's happened as a detective. And I went, well, that's interesting. And so I got on the plane and I flew home and I don't know why, but on the plane, I wrote the first 16 pages of the script and it just flowed out of me. I've never had an experience on a script like that before where it just consumed me and just flowed out the way this one did. It was like there was a muse moving through me in a way I'd never experienced before. And so consequently it came out the way it did. Now, the producers, and I understand why, they felt they had to appeal more to a faith-based audience.
Yeah.
So they made some changes that I would not have made. They took things out of it. I had a whole subplot where the lead character, Clavius, the Roman, he had a relationship with a Jewish woman, a secret relationship. And that was a whole subplot that went throughout that I quite liked a lot. Well, they took that out because they were afraid that the faith-based audience would be offended by that, you know, and just little things like that, that it was a different direction from what I really wanted to do.
Because it got sold hard in America and then it barely got a release over here,
right?
Just because faith-based stuff, what they'd gone so hard on selling it as a faith-based picture in America, and that doesn't sell as well here in the UK.
It doesn't.
By the time you came to the end of that, because that's your last credit to date, was there a conscious decision that you don't want to play that game anymore? I remember you saying you had one script you'd written, a comedy that was Crossing Mediterranean and the Pink Panther, and you also had a swashbuckler with the Monte Cristo guys. That was your quote as well. But were there other projects after that you wanted to get going, or you just like had your fill a little bit?
I've had two or three I really would like to do, but you know, with no luck, I sit down, I wrote another one. I sat down, was compelled to write, was kind of seeing what the political situation all in the States was. It was about four people just completely down on their luck, utterly depressed. You know, one's a school teacher, one's a guy with a degree in archaeology, can't get arrested, so he drives a garbage truck, and a burned out veteran who sits in front of his TV all day smoking dope, and a guy in his 50s who has been fired from his job of his age, and everywhere they turn they cannot get a break, and ultimately they get so downtrodden they decide they're going to start a revolution. And that's what you watch them do. Is it's almost like a Zia Costa-Gavras picture from, you know, the 60s. They decide to start a revolution, and you watch them do it. And I've tried desperately to get people to let me make it, and they go, great writing, we love it, but it's too controversial, we won't do it. And I can't get it done.
I know there are a few projects you're trying to get moving at the moment. I want to see a new film off you.
Do what?
I want to see a new film off you. I mean.
Well, thank you. I'd like to do it again. I think I've still got a few left in the can that I could do. But, when you get to be my age, there's less and less interest in you. You know, they want stuff from a newer generation.
Well, I think given your back catalogue of movies and TV stuff as well, I look at it with some degree of envy, really. That's not a bad collection of work from someone who got into a car with $300 and just kind of wondering, you know, I think if I'd have offered you that back at the start of the 80s, you might just have taken that.
Yeah, I listen, I've been very fortunate. I mean, you know, all things considered, and You see all the people that strive to have a career in this insane business. I've been extremely fortunate. And just try to keep it in perspective and realize that.
Well, I hope you get that new film off the ground, and I look forward to seeing it. Kevin Reynolds, this has been a delight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Simon.
And that was my conversation with Kevin Reynolds. Ordinarily, I would give you social media accounts of the person I've talked to where you can catch up with them. But as Mr. Reynolds pointed out, he's not on social media, but you can find the vast bulk of his films available on an assortment of streaming services, and occasionally they get big screen outings as well. You can find more from me if you want it, though. I'm on Twitter at Simon Brew. The entire Film Stories project is on Twitter at Film Stories Pod. If you want to support the work that we're doing, I'm on Patreon at patreon.com/Simon Brew. I use the money from that to pay new and upcoming writers to write for the website that you'll find at filmstories.co.uk, all sorts of features and news and reviews and bits on there. It also helps to fund the podcast as well. Also, Film Stories has a bunch of magazines. You can find those at store.filmstories.co.uk. We're a fully independent operation. I say we, it's me sat in a room, but you know, it turns out you can do quite a lot when you're sat in a room. Thank you so much for all of your support. Thank you so much for listening. And thank you this week in particular to Kevin Reynolds for being so generous with his time. Most important thing, as always, is you all take care and you stay safe. And I'll be back soon with your regular episode of Film Stories. You all take care. Bye-bye.